Okay, so anyway, in the absence of the organizers, I should probably introduce myself and get started. So I was asked to talk about recent work done in collaboration with Rob Myers and Rowan Thompson, excuse me, and a couple of postdocs at Perimeter Institute, and Leo Patino, who was a postdoc here last year, whose aim is to try to use ADS-CFT, or the gauge gravity duality, to learn something about a specific phase of QCD, namely the deconfined phase, the quark gluon plasma phase that's been studied at RIC. So I would like to start with a somewhat long introduction, because I'd like to give you my personal perspective on the topic. And then I'll move on to discussing, by the way, I should clarify that the word fundamental in the title doesn't necessarily mean that this is very important. It means it refers to the fact that I will be concentrating on the behavior of fundamental matter, degrees of freedom in the fundamental representation of the gauge group in the SUN gauge theory that we will be studying, just like the quarks are in the fundamental in QCD. That's what I'll be focusing on. So the phase transitions part here will refer to phase transitions that reflect changes in the behavior of the mesons in the theory, quark anti-quark bound states. Then in the introduction I'll discuss a famous bound on the viscosity of the entropy density that's attracted a lot of attention. And then in the third point, I'll ask the question of, are there corrections to this conjectured bound that come from the introduction of fundamental degrees of freedom, namely from the quarks? Then in the fourth point, I'll discuss how this physics changes when you introduce a finite chemical potential or a finite baryon number density. And if I have time, I'll talk about bright brains, or equivalently photon and dilepton production by strongly coupled plasmas, which is something that's also of interest at RIC. Okay, so I'm hoping that at the very least we'll get to point number two here. So before I get into any details, let me remind you of why we actually haven't solved QCD altogether yet using the ADS-CFT duality. After all, the regime of QCD that we don't know how to solve perturbatively is the infrared strongly coupled regime, and the ADS-CFT duality is a strong weak coupling duality, so you might think that you would be able to use a weakly coupled description in terms of string theory to solve the infrared regime in QCD. So the reason why that's not the case is the following. Imagine you start with a theory that has a UV conformal interacting fixed point, like n equals 4 super Young Mills. And you give a mass, let's call it Kaluza-Klein mass, to all the fields in this theory except for the glue. Okay, so that breaks all the supersymmetries. And you would expect that this theory at low energies will then develop a strong coupling scale, lambda QCD, and it will confine, and hopefully it will describe in the infrared the same physics, or you might hope it's in the same universality class as pure Young Mills, let's just say pure Young Mills, if we were trying to solve that. Okay? But of course, the problem is that below this scale, the coupling will run logarithmically. And so this lambda QCD scale is related to the scale at which you give a mass to all your fields that you don't want in your infrared theory in the following way, where G squared is the Young-Mills coupling constant at that scale, and N is just the number of colors. So what you see from here is that if you want to decouple the physics that takes place at the QCD scale or at the strong coupling scale that you're interested in from all the extra modes that you don't want because you just want to study pure Young-Mills and that's what you would like to solve, if you want to do that, then you have to take G squared N to be very small at that scale so that this exponential suppresses. So these two scales are hierarchically separated, exponentially separated. Okay, so decoupling means that G squared N is must be much, much smaller than one. But of course, if you want to trust the dual supergravity description, you know that the curvature in string units scales typically like 1 over g squared n. And so if you want low curvatures, you need to take g squared n to be much larger than 1. So in the regime in which supergravity is applicable, these two scales are not hierarchically separated, and what you are studying is not really pure Young-Mills, but say pure Young-Mills together with an extra lot of fields that have masses at the same order of lambda QCD. And so there is no decoupling, and you're not really studying the same universality class in principle. That's the problem that is ubiquitous in all these gauge gravity correspondences. Any questions about that? So what does this mean in terms of how useful this can be? Well, it means that if you're trying to, say, calculate the detailed spectrum, mass spectrum of QCD at zero temperature, for example, that will presumably require going beyond supergravity. You will probably have to do string theory, and that will still be in the large n limit. However, that doesn't mean that there are some predictions that the gauge gravity correspondence can make that cannot be universal enough to apply to QCD, at least in certain regimes. Okay, so the idea is that in the absence of being able to do string theory in certain backgrounds, we're going to look for universal predictions that are universal enough so that we have a hope that they might only rely on the theory being non-abelian and strongly coupled, etc., and so that they might apply to QCD in certain regimes. And I'm going to discuss one example in which that seems to be the case. And before you ask me, I will say that understanding exactly what regimes and what observables have that robustness is part of the challenge. So one of my favorite examples is the calculation of the so-called viscosity, shear viscosity over entropy density ratio. It has been conjectured based on ADS CFT calculations that any relativistic quantum field theory at finite temperature that exhibits at long wavelengths a hydrodynamic behavior, such as QCD is expected to exhibit, will have a ratio of the shear viscosity over the entropy density that is bounded from below by 1 over 4 pi in some units. This was conjectured to be a universal bound by Pavel and Dantanson and Andrei Starinets. And it has attracted a lot of attention in the experimental and theoretical QCD community because the quark gluon plasma that seems to be created at RIC seems to exhibit a ratio that comes very close, or relatively close, to 1 over 4 pi, within a factor of 2 or 4. So I'm going to elaborate on this. But before I do that, just to give you an idea of the fact that this has attracted attention, let me read you a little passage from a paper by somebody who knows something about QCD, this Edward Shuriak. He wrote in a review paper, "One revolutionary advance took place on the theoretical front. String theorists," and then in brackets, Maldacena, "pointed out that one can treat n equals 4 super Young-Mills in strong coupling regime by considering a weakly coupled supergravity problem. It can be done both at zero and finite temperature and resulted in a number of fascinating," and then in brackets, "although rather incomprehensible, results." So it seems that it's good news that some results coming from, motivated by ADS CFT, seem to have found some application directly to, or potential application to, experiment. Yeah.
So this is something you derive in the large radius theory.
That's right.
And are you going to explain why it should be universal and continue through to...
Yeah, so, right, so I will elaborate on that, yeah. So if I don't elaborate enough, please ask me again. Yeah.
Just to clarify, one can derive this bound within the process of gravity and safety, is that right?
Under certain assumptions.
Under certain assumptions.
Yes. So this has gone, the generality of the proof has been broadened.
One can derive the equality within certain assumptions in gauge gravity correspondence. One cannot derive the inequality.
That's right, but you can compute in certain cases the first alpha prime correction. So if you go beyond, so the idea is the following. The reason the equality is universal for any theory, any gauge theory that has a gravity dual, is that this is essentially, my take on the story is that this is essentially a property of horizons. So the idea is that any finite temperature gauge theory, you have to be a little more specific about, for example, the initial proof relied on having a background that's static, not only stationary, for example. But under certain assumptions, you can prove that if the relevant action is the supergravity action, this will follow. But then if you include, for example, high derivative corrections, like alpha prime corrections, what those do is to actually raise this value above the bound. They don't violate the bound, but it's no longer saturated. And this in the gauge theory corresponds to the statement. So I'm running a little bit ahead of myself, but let's do it anyway. You could ask, what is this ratio, for example, in perturbation theory at weak coupling? And what you find, typically, is that if you plot here lambda and here this ratio, at weak coupling, this ratio diverges. And at strong coupling, what you find from ADS CFT is that it approaches 1 over 4 pi. So at weak coupling, eta over s goes like some number over lambda to the fourth, I believe, or lambda squared, sorry, times log of another number over root lambda. So you see that weak coupling, this is very large. At strong coupling, the result from ADS CFT tells you that it goes to 1 over 4 pi. And if you compute, so that's in the limit of infinite strong coupling. If you compute the first 1 over lambda correction, or alpha prime correction, it raises it slightly above 1 over 4 pi. So it's consistent to believe that what's going to do is to, the simplest assumption is that it's going to decrease in this way. And the reason why people were surprised at the fact that at RIC this ratio was found to be so small is that there was a widespread expectation that the quark gluon plasma that they were going to create just above the deconfinement temperature would be weakly coupled. So if you believe that the perturbative description is appropriate just as soon as you go above the deconfinement phase transition, then you would get a result of this sort, and there's no way to explain then why it is so small. The reason for that widespread expectation is that it's the thermodynamics. So if you look at lattice simulations of QCD, and you plot, for example, the energy density over T to the fourth as a function of the temperature over the critical temperature, the deconfinement temperature, so deconfinement is here at 1, then you find that this does something like this. And if you plot here, if you normalize it so that 1 corresponds to the Stefan-Boltzmann free result for free gas of quarks and gluons, then this value here is about 0.8. So what this graph was interpreted in the following way. It was interpreted as saying that lattice simulations indicate that there's a very rapid crossover for QCD around a temperature that's around 175 MeVs, such that as soon as you cross that region, for example, the energy density and other thermodynamic quantities attain a value that's 80% of the value of a free gas of quarks and gluons. So it's almost the free value. This 20% discrepancy was interpreted as meaning, well, there is some residual interaction yet that we have to account for. But essentially, it's very weakly coupled, and that's why it behaves almost as a free gas. Okay. Now, remember that if you do the strong coupling calculation and the weak coupling calculation n equals 4, you get that the free result is 1, and the strong coupling result is 0.75, it's 3 quarters. And 3 quarters is much closer to 0.8 than 1. So a posteriori, we realized that we should not have interpreted this thermodynamic behavior as indicating that the theory is weakly coupled, okay? Because we know that there are theories that have a very similar behavior in the thermodynamics. Whereas the hydrodynamics, or the transport coefficients, okay, behave very, very differently. They're very tiny in a strongly coupled theory and huge in a weakly coupled theory.
David, what is that entropy calculation again? I mean, maybe I see a piece of it like open supersymmetry. Is there still a factor of free force? Is there
just... Sorry, say that again?
How do you differentiate that free force result in the ABS-CFT calculation? If I try to do it the setting where I've broken supersymmetry, I'm still getting 0.75 times the...
Well, you're doing it at finite temperature, so you have broken supersymmetry.
If I break supersymmetry at zero temperature and calculate it in that theory, is it the same exponent? Do we know? I'm just wondering how seriously you take this argument. If I really had an ABS-CFT setting that's closer to QCD, I'm just thinking solving a separation of scales problem, would I expect that in fact I predict 0.75, or would I think I might get 1.3 or 0.2?
Well, as long as you get, okay, so let me answer in step by step. I think what the calculation for n equals 4 shows is that this is a, here's a perfectly concrete example where you do the calculation at finite temperature and you get something unexpected, which is that they are almost the same, okay? If you do it in a different theory and you get a different number, if it's not 3/4, if it's 5/2 or whatever it is, I would still morally draw the same conclusion, which is that you might have, in fact, for example, there is no reason to expect that the, you know, that you have a finite well-defined limit when you go to infinite strong coupling and so on. So as long as you have a finite limit, that's just a number that differs by a number from the weak coupling result, namely it doesn't differ by parametrically in n, for example, or anything like that, I think you would draw the same conclusion. So I don't want to put too much weight on the fact that 0.8 is close to 3/4. That was just, it's a happy coincidence, but.
One question. I sort of missed it. How big a discrepancy is experimentally this discrepancy between the weak coupling result and the observations? You said that the 1 over 4 pi is within a factor of 2 or so.
Yes.
But I don't know numerically how to interpret the weak coupling result. Because you have a coefficient there.
Oh, this one here. Okay, I would have to give you these coefficients are calculated for, this has been calculated for QCD with different numbers of colors. I can give you the value of the coefficients, for example.
Okay.
So for QCD with 3 flavors, this one up here, this is A and B. So A is 46.1.
Okay.
And B is 4.17. And then you just have to decide what value of lambda is appropriate just above the deconfinement phase transition, which, if I'm not mistaken, is around 18. Is that right, Pavel?
Well, it depends how you scale. So if you naively extrapolate this perturbative result, I mean, if you take lambda evaluated at a scale given by the temperature within some MF bar scheme, and you naively extrapolate this perturbative result to T equal to 2, 3 TC, then you get eta over S is about 1.5 to 1.8. So, and 1 over 4 pi is 0.4.
Right.
Yeah.
So almost just 50 to 100 or something.
20.
I'm sorry, 20. Excuse me. 20.
Yeah.
But then these perturbative results assume arbitrarily small coupling.
That's right.
Then extrapolate.
That's right.
Alpha.
Okay, so any more questions about that? Good. So what I'd like to do then is the idea for the rest is to exploit or explore, at least, another universal feature. So, well, let me make a couple of comments before I move on. The first one is that when this calculation, this ratio was computed for the first time for n equals 4 and other theories, it wasn't known, and I don't know if it wasn't even expected, that it was going to be universal. What happened is this calculation was done for n equals 4, then it was done for other theories, and the result was always 1 over 4 pi, and then people started wondering whether that was there was actually something, a mechanism behind that was guaranteeing that result. So the first lesson is that we should be open-minded and compute everything we can, and you know, try to keep an eye on what could be universal, but you don't know a priori.
You always get the 1 over 4 pi from the horizon.
Yeah, so this basically, this 1 over 4 pi comes from the fact that using ADS CFT, well, the entropy density is just the area of the horizon. So since you asked, so the S is just A over 4 pi G Newton, sorry, 4 G Newton. And eta is related. You can show that this is given by the absorption is proportional to the absorption cross section of the horizon at zero frequency for a scalar field. And that in turn is related to the area. That's what gives you the cross section. And the coefficient turns out to be 16 pi G Newton. So when you take the ratio, the area and G Newton cancel, and you get 1 over 4 pi. It's as simple as that. That's in a nutshell what the idea is. So it's a universal property of horizons.
Since you raised this issue originally, you might think if you had a horizon with hair on it, that you wouldn't have this property. That if you had, you know, some sort of monopole mass of horizon, extended field profile, that things would reflect off of it and change the absorption cross section. Is that a case to be studied?
Yes, you can certainly have, for example, yeah, you can have complicated backgrounds that have asymptotically ADS boundary conditions, but have dilaton, running dilatons, etc.,
yeah.
Things like that. Yes, yes. Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So the point is there's absolutely no known exception to this bound.
Tell me if this question is more appropriate for later, but I can't resist at this stage. So, if eta over s is somehow universal, do you expect the horizon to be universal somehow?
What do you mean by the horizon to be universal?
Well, the fact that there is something that really is, you know, has a horizon in some sense, is a black hole geometry in some sense.
Well, that. Okay. First of all, to call it a horizon, you have to be in a regime in which geometry means something.
Right. Yeah,
classical. Yeah, absolutely. So I think the take is, my take on the story is that the reason why QCD just above the deconfinement space transition has such a small ratio is an indication that in that limited regime, there is. For certain questions you can ask, I'm not claiming that for anything you can ask, but for certain questions, there is an appropriate dual description in which you should think of having a horizon.
I mean, you're getting at one property of a black hole, roughly.
Yes.
And the question is, do you have other properties?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's the topic of the rest of the talk. Yeah. So, the idea then is, as has been emphasized, this relies on a universal property of the gauge gravity duality, which is the fact that when you have a strongly coupled theory in a deconfined phase at finite temperature, the dual background has a horizon. Okay. Another rather universal feature is that in all the calculations in many of the calculations for which this had been explicitly tested, the gauge theory in question had only matter in the adjoint representation of the gauge group. So you may ask the question of whether changing the representation of the matter, in particular considering fundamental degrees of freedom, changes the story in any way. Okay, that's obviously an interesting question in view of the fact that QCD has quarks in the fundamental representation. So luckily, if you want to include fundamental matter, and you want to restrict yourself to a number of flavors that is kept fixed as you send a number of colors to infinity, which is what you do in the standard toothed limit, then there is a very easy way of incorporating fundamental matter in this type of dualities. So we will work with the number of flavors being much smaller than a number of colors. And then the statement is that this may be represented, and I'll give you more details in a second, by including D-brain probes in the original background. This is a rather universal statement. And what I'd like to do then is to explore whether there are universal properties in the behavior, in the dynamics of D-brain probes in backgrounds that possess a horizon. Okay, because that will tell me about universal features of fundamental degrees of freedom in deconfined gauge theories. Okay, so to explain why this is the case, let me very quickly remind you of the way you motivate the gauge gravity duality, and then we'll incorporate the fundamental degrees of freedom. So imagine you start with a bunch of DP brains, NC of them. This system is an interacting system that contains open strings and closed strings in string theory. But you can take a decoupling limit in which the two sectors decouple from each other, segregate essentially. In one of them, you're left with the dynamics of the open strings on the DP brains. So you end up with P plus one dimensional super Young Mills, which has only matter in the adjoint representation. And in the other one, you end up with closed strings propagating in some curved background sourced by the DP brains. So you replace the DP brains by some smooth supergravity solution. And in the case P equals 3, you get a nice ADS5 geometry. And there is a holographic duality between this theory and this one here. Okay? And these closed strings are dual to global states in the original theory, or stage built out of adjoint matter. Okay? But now suppose that I play the same game, but before I take the decoupling limit, I introduce NF DQ brains, where Q is possibly different from P, and they intersect along some common D directions. What this does is to introduce in this system two new types of strings. Now I have the PQ strings and the QP strings and the QQ strings. So you can argue that when you take the decoupling limit, what happens is that now these ones end up on this side. And because they only have one endpoint on the DP brains, which is what gives you the SUNC gauge group, they transform in the fundamental representation of the gauge group. So what you get is NF flavors in the fundamental of SUNC, or more precisely, NF hypermultiplets in the fundamental. And these ones here, these open strings, the QQ strings, end up on this side, because when you replace, because the number of DQ brains is so much smaller than the number of DP brains, when I replace the DP brains by their supergravity background, I can ignore, as an approximation, the back reaction on that background of the DQ brains and just treat them as a probe in that background. This is analogous completely to the fact that in QCD, in the large N limit, you treat the quarks as probes of the glue dynamics. Okay? If quarks run in loops, then you get diagrams that are suppressed in the large N limit. So in this description, what you get is a bunch of NF DQ brains, which of course means that now you have an open string sector on this side. And these open strings are now going to be dual to meson states, namely states built out of fundamental matter in the gauge theory. Is the setup clear? Okay. So let's then ask the question of what happens if we consider the dynamics of NFDQ brain probes in the background of NC black DP brains. Black because I want to have the theory at finite temperature, so I want the DP brains to have a horizon. So I'm just going to draw a picture and explain what the physics is. This point here represents all the directions along the DP brains. So they look like a point. And the blackboard is the transverse space to the DP brains. Because they are at finite temperature, there's a finite area horizon around the DP brains. And then what we are studying is what happens when we place NF DQ probes in such a background. And the first thing you realize, well, first of all, obviously, you have to fix the boundary conditions at infinity for your DQ brains. That corresponds to, for example, fixing the mass of the quarks. So this asymptotic distance between the DQs and the DPs is what fixes the mass of the PQ strings, which are the fundamental flavor, so that fixes the quark mass. So once you fix those boundary conditions, you may very well guess, and it's correct, that the DQ brains, because there is a black hole here, and you've broken supersymmetry, will be attracted to the black hole. And then there are two possibilities for the qualitative possibilities for what the embedding of the DQ brains might be. The first one is that they bend a little bit, but don't fall into the black hole. And the second one, if this quark mass compared to the temperature of the black hole is small enough, is that they actually bend and fall all the way on the black hole.
This is a separate question, but this theory here,
absolutely, thank you. Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. So I didn't want to give too many details, but that's absolutely correct. So what Albion is pointing out is that these degrees of freedom, these PP strings, they propagate along P plus one dimensions because both endpoints are on the P brains. Okay? So the gauge fields and the adjoint matter propagate in P plus one dimensions. But these ones that give you the fundamental degrees of freedom have one point here and one point here. So the light degrees of freedom, the massless ones actually, are only those that are localized at the intersection. And those only propagate along the common directions, which are d-dimensional. So what this theory really is P plus one super Young nils with a defect on it of dimension d, along which you have localized fundamental degrees of freedom that propagate.
So
one way to obtain, for example, a theory that lives in the same dimension is to take the extra directions here and compactify them, say, in a torus, for example. So you reduce the theory to a d plus one dimensional theory coupled to a tower of exactly. But in fact, one of the nice things about that, so imagine these were D4 brains, and these were D6 brains. That's a nice system, because then there's only one that they intersect over a three plus one dimensional defect. So the D4s only have one direction orthogonal to the D6s. If you compactify that direction and you give the fermions antiperiodic boundary conditions, you break supersymmetry. So that's going back to Don's question. You can break supersymmetry before adding temperature. And then that theory at low temperatures confines when And I'll have something more to say about that in a second. But I didn't want...
As you said before,
it's absolutely, absolutely. But I'll come back to this example in a second. For the moment, what I'm going to do is to assume that the relevant background is one that has a black hole horizon in it, because even if we started with a confining theory, we have heated it up so that we are in the deconfined phase. Okay, so this guess is correct. These are the two qualitative types of embeddings. But in fact, there is another one, which is what we call the critical embedding, which is one in which is singular, in which the brains just touch the horizon at one point. Okay? So now, let's ask the question of what happens if I start with a fixed quark mass and I increase the temperature, or vice versa, if I fix the temperature and I decrease the quark mass. In either case, it's clear that there's going to be a phase transition. Because if I fix the quark mass and increase the temperature, eventually the black hole will grow and swallow the brain. So I will go from one embedding of this type to one of this type. Because of the existence of this critical embedding, you might have thought that this phase transition will be of second order, not first order, because you will continuously, or almost continuously, go from this to that and then to a black hole type embedding. So by the way, we call these ones Minkowski embeddings and these ones black hole embeddings. But that's not what happens. If you look at the free energy of the system, you realize that as you increase the temperature, there is a point at which this embedding, which is thermodynamically preferred for low temperatures, eventually jumps into one of these, which is then the one that's preferred for high temperatures. And because it happens discontinuously and you skip over this one, the transition is first order. This statement is universal. Essentially universal, I can give you the caveat behind essentially later, but it's essentially universal for all DPDQ systems. There's a first order phase transition at which the brains jump from a Minkowski embedding to a black hole embedding. So what does this mean in terms of...
First order phase transition in what?
So this is characterized by, for example, by a discontinuous change in physical quantities, like, for example, the quark condensate jumps discontinuously, or the entropy density, for example, etc.
But it's a function of the temperature divided by the...
Yes, it's a function of T over the quark mass. No. So here, as I said, let's imagine that I'm doing this, for example, for N equals 4 super young Mills. So my DP brains here are D3 brains. This is one of the simplest examples. And these are D7 brains. So this N equals 4 super young Mills theory is not a confining theory. At any temperature, even at zero temperature, it's not confining. And then when I add the 7 brains, that doesn't change. So there is no lambda QCD in this theory. The only scale in that particular case would be the temperature and the quark mass. And this phase transition, of course, happens as a function of this ratio. So let me explain. Did I answer your question?
So what happens? That doesn't go to zero in any
right? No, that's right. So it jumps discontinuously, but it's not zero neither here nor here. Yeah. So it's not a sharp order parameter that's zero or non-zero. Yeah. And in fact, the temperature at which the phase transition takes place, which we call T fun for fundamental, is set by the mass, which I'm going to call M bar, by the mass of the lightest meson in the theory at zero temperature. So in this particular case, imagine you take the D3, D7 system at zero temperature, but you give the quarks a mass. Okay, so the theory is not confining, but it still has quark anti-quark bound states. Now those meson bound states have a lightest meson. There's a mass gap. And that's what sets the scale of the phase transition. I'm mentioning this because I will attempt a comparison to QCD in a second. And this will be important. But let me, before I get to that, let me... Good, thank you. So in the D3D7 case, for example, that's a very interesting point. This goes like MQ divided by root lambda, where lambda is the tooth coupling, and we are at strong coupling. So one of the most relevant features of these systems is that at strong coupling, your mesons are extremely deeply bound because their mass is much, much smaller than the quark mass. Yeah, so this is much more than MQ.
Smaller.
Yeah. Much less, yes. Thank you. Yeah, so they are very deeply bound. Okay, so let me characterize a little bit more what happens to the meson spectrum when this phase transition takes place. So, when the favored embedding is of this type, the meson spectrum is discrete and it possesses a mass gap. Okay? It's very easy to see that because if you look at the induced metric on the D brains, to look for the meson spectrum, you have to look at modes, find normalizable fluctuations on the brains. And if you look at the induced metric, you realize that essentially you're solving the same problem as in, for example, global ADS. So it's, you have a potential that's like a box, and the set of normalizable modes is discrete, and there is a mass gap. And if you look at the constituent quark mass, that corresponds to a string that stretches from the lowest point on the brains to the horizon. And that's massive. So the constituent quarks are massive. There's a non-zero cost to introducing a quark. Whereas when the brains fall into the horizon, because the induced metric on the brains now has a horizon itself, the spectrum is no longer discrete. It becomes continuous. And there is no mass gap. And the constituent quarks become massless because there's no distance between the brains and the horizon. And one thing that's interesting that comes out from this analysis is that the contribution from the brains to physical quantities, say for example to the entropy density, so, for example, the entropy density, the contribution from the brains goes like nf times nc times lambda times t cube. So the dependence on the temperature, so this is for massless quarks. If we have massless quarks, the only scale is the temperature, so you expect it to scale like t cube. The dependence on nf and nc is expected from large n counting rules. For adjoint matter, it would scale like nc squared, or for gluons. But the power of lambda here is a prediction from the duality. And it means that at strong coupling, the contribution from fundamental matter to the entropy density diverges. You should compare this with the previous discussion we had that said that, so this is for fundamental matter, that said that for the n equals 4, for example, this goes like nc squared times t cubed with no powers of the coupling. And that is the reason why you can compare the strong coupling result to the weak coupling result. Okay, so let me come back to this point here and see what we get if we try to use this as a toy model for QCD. So the basic physics that I'm describing here is that if you have a theory that deconfines, you can still have quark-antiquark bound states that survive the deconfinement phase transition. if the quark mass is large enough. Okay? Now, this is exactly what happens in QCD. In QCD, if you look at lattice simulations for spectral functions, what people find is that, for example, Charmonium-bound states, CC-bar states, like J-psi, survive the deconfinement phase transition, which takes place at around 175 MeVs, and only melt or dissociate at temperatures around 1.65 times the deconfinement temperature, which is about 289 MeVs. So even though the theory is not in a confining phase anymore, the Coulomb interaction, the residual Coulomb interaction, is strong enough to keep the certain quark-antiquark states bound way beyond the deconfinement temperature.
So this phase transition when the D7 brain falls into the black hole has nothing to do with the deconfinement, right?
Exactly, it has nothing to do with that. And in fact, just to make that even more clear, because that's an important point, let me draw a picture here. Suppose you start, coming back to your question, suppose you start with a confining theory. So if you start with a confining theory and you introduce fundamental degrees of freedom, you will have a background that has no horizon. It's just a smooth background. And then your brains will happily lie in some embedding in that background. Now, when you heat up that theory, at large n, eventually you hit the so-called deconfinement phase transition, which in the gravity description is the Hawking page phase transition. So in the gravity description, what happens is that the background that dominates the partition function jumps from being one with no horizon to one with a black hole horizon in it. Okay? So when that takes place, there are two possibilities. Either the quark mass is large enough so that when you actually generate your black hole, the brain still sits outside. And if that's the case, it means that the bounds, the mesons associated to that quark mass survive. Or if you started with a quark mass that was smaller, when the background undergoes this Hawking page phase transition, the black hole will be big enough to actually swallow the brain. And that means that at the same time that you deconfine, the mesons become unbound. So depending on the relationship between the deconfinement temperature and the quark mass, these theories can have one phase transition at which both things happen at the same time, or two phase transitions. Is that point clear? So in QCD, what I'm saying is that for sufficiently heavy quarks, like the charm quark, for example, there are two phase transitions. There is the deconfinement phase transition and then another one, or rather I should say a crossover, most likely, at which, even though the glue is already deconfined, what happens is that the corresponding mesons dissociate or ionize. Okay, so this is just a geometric large N simple description of that complicated strong coupling physics.
What's the parametric dependence of the melting temperature on the quark mass?
Yeah, so here, as I was saying, the...
Oh, it's just...
Let me tell you, for example, for the D3, D7 case, what you get is that the temperature for T1, at which the mesons melt, is approximately...
It's this meson.
Yeah, it's 0.122 times the mass of the lightest meson in the theory at zero temperature. So for example, for the J-psi, if you apply this formula, the J-psi has a mass around 3,000 MeV. So if you multiply, what you get is 366 MeV to be compared with this one here. So I don't want to put any weight on this. If you do it, for example, for the D4, D6, what you get is this number here is 0.234. So you get something that's a little bit more off. this. But for example, if you look at, instead of CC bar bound states, you look at strange quark bound states, those are also supposed seen to survive, surprisingly, the deconfinement phase transition. And you can play the same game and compare. And it's roughly in the right ballpark, but basically, I just want to advocate the qualitative physics. I'm not trying to claim that you can make detailed predictions for the numbers.
Are you making an assumption that n is already large when n equals 3?
That's an implicit assumption in the fact that I'm comparing, yes.
This deconfinement phase transition, how would it seem with the I mean, you're saying swims black hole forms. I'm not sure what this off the page transition is. If you're increasing all the sort of black hole forms, what is changing in this picture here?
In which one?
In the picture with the in the case when you have the confinement phase transition, presumably you don't have any finite energy coming up in that.
Good.
How do I see that in this picture? What's going on?
Not here. So in this picture that I was drawing here, very good. If you don't have a black hole, so if you have a black hole, then there are finite mass free quarks in your theory, because you can have a string that has only one endpoint on the D brains, on the DQ brains, and that goes through the horizon. So because it has only one endpoint here, it behaves like a quark or anti-quark, depending on convention. Okay, but if there is no black hole, and you're in a confining background, then this string has nowhere to end except to come back to the brain. It's not allowed to end in thin air. And so what that means is that you don't have free quarks. The only thing you have are bound states of quark and antiquark, mesons. Those you still have.
But how do I see that in this picture?
No, you won't see that in this picture, because this is a weak coupling, picture. So what this is, when you replace the DP brains by their supergravity background, what that's doing for you is giving you, at the very least, a pictorial representation of the strong coupling dynamics. So for example, all confining, the characterization of confining backgrounds is that if you look at Wilson loops, eventually the string that hangs from the boundary reaches a minimum, and then in order to become longer and longer, it has to stay there, and that's what gives you a linear potential. And that's basically because the string has nowhere to end. If you have a background with a horizon, then when you separate the quark and the antiquark, eventually the string will break. And there will no more be any interaction between the quark and the antiquark, and you don't get a linear, an area law at long distances.
Okay, so before the black hole forms, you say confinement. You have a deconfinement phase transition that occurs at a certain temperature.
Yes.
Is the temperature divided by what now?
Right. That depends on how you generated confinement in your model. So for example, if you take the simplest one that I know of, which is Witten's original model, what you do is you take D4 brains. That's what I was referring to before. Take D4 brains. These are 4 plus 1 dimensional objects. Wrap one of their directions on an S1 and call that S1 KK. So you dimensionally reduce from 4 plus 1 to 3 plus 1. But you do it in a way that you break supersymmetry. You can show that the corresponding dual background exhibits confinement. And then the deconfinement temperature is set by the Kaluza-Klein scale, namely 1 over the radius of this circle. Okay, so maybe I'll just take 5 more minutes to go to, are there any questions, further questions about this? Okay, so maybe at least I'd like to quickly mention point 3, which is, as I was saying before, what happens to this universal conjecture bound on the viscosity over the entropy density? If you now include fundamental degrees of freedom in the way that I've been describing. One of the reasons you might want to do that is that the contribution from fundamental degrees of freedom to any quantity in a large N theory is suppressed with respect to the contribution from the glue by NF over NC. For example, as I was saying, the entropy density goes like some number times NC squared T cubed, that comes from the glue, plus some other number, NF NC T cubed. This comes from the fundamental degrees of freedom. And as you see, it's suppressed by NF over NC with respect to the leading result. So introducing fundamental degrees of freedom is a way also of probing 1 over N effects in this viscosity band, which of course we would like to know whether, in order to apply to see how reliable it can be applied to QCD, we would like to know whether 1 over N effects are important. So the result we found is that to leading order in an F over NC, not only the bound is not modified, but it's actually still saturated. Okay, so how do you do the calculation of the viscosity in the case in which you have these extra D-brain probes? Remember that to calculate eta, this can be extracted via a so-called Kubo formula from the two-point function of two stress-energy tensors in the gauge theory. It's a zero-frequency limit of a two-point function, two-point correlator of two stress-energy tensors. This, in ADS-CFT, can be calculated by taking two functional derivatives with respect to the metric of the effective action, which is the supergravity action, in the case in which you don't have any D-brain probes. If you have D-brain probes, as we do here when we introduce fundamental matter, then this action includes the supergravity action plus the D-brain's action. So the whole, it's a technical, relatively technical exercise that took us some time, but in the end you can convince yourself that even though you're modifying the action by adding this extra piece corresponding to the D-brains, you can actually convince yourself that the result, you can reduce the calculation to one in, for which there are general theorems that guarantee that this will be equal to 1 over 4 pi. General theorems of the sort that I alluded to before, like relating it to the absorption cross-section of the horizon, etc. So just to conclude, let me emphasize it again. To this order, the first correction coming from the fundamental matter, you can actually show that the bound is still saturated. Not only it's not violated, but it's still exactly saturated. So it would be interesting to know if one can make statements that go beyond this 1 over n effect to, say, order 1 over n squared, etc. But at least to this order, it is still exactly saturated. Yes?
So you take actually energy infinity, right, to treat this as a black correction. But you have to consider the correction of NF over energy. Mm-hmm. To do that, you take also NF infinity.
It's an expansion. So I'm not really taking N to infinity. You never...
Which
N? NC.
You don't take NC.
You don't really set NC to infinity. Because then, for example, the ADS radius is infinity, etc. What you're really doing is an expansion in 1 over NC and in NF over NC.
So by taking this as a finite correction, and then you check that this eta over NC is...
Exactly. So are there any more questions? I don't want to overrun too much because there's another seminar I have to present. So.
I don't want to overrun, but you were going to say there are other parameters you can calculate which are sort of universal.
No, there are not as far as I know to this level. When I said there are other universal properties, I meant, for example, the existence of a first order phase transition for fundamental matter.
Yeah,
as a function of the ratio between the temperature and the quark mass. That's a universal statement you can make that applies to all models. Now, for example, as I was saying, what is the precise temperature at which that phase transition happens when I was comparing it to the QCD temperature for the JPSI? That depends on the model. But the existence of a first order phase transition, that's a universal property of these models. That's what I meant when I was replying to Steve before.
So that's sort of the exhaustive list of known universal properties.
Well, I don't want to make such a strong claim because I could always be missing.
Of known to you universal properties.
Off the top of my head, yes. It is, because for heavy enough quarks, what this is saying is that there is always a separation between confinement, deconfinement. Doesn't depend on what direction you go. Confinement, deconfinement, and ionization of your, or binding of your mesons. Sorry? Exactly. Yeah, so even though I presented everything oriented to weak applications, this is certainly another situation in which that's applicable, yeah.
I can make an advertisement, maybe. Next week they asked me to give a talk, and maybe I'll try and say something about a possible universality in the friction coefficient for quarks and these kinds of models.
I have one more question. We're setting this in string theory, right? And as far as the string landscape is concerned, is this a point in the string landscape that there are any fundamental problems associated with it, or is it just a big point in the string landscape?
The way I think about it is a completely different game.
Why?
Because I'm not trying to.
What? People are not real. These aren't real convective
people. It's not convective at all. It's not convective. Yeah. So that's the difference. It's real.
Well, I hope it is real than any other.
Well,
it's not. It's a metaphor.
This you could think of as what.
If you're making black holes, they're not real black holes. They're mathematical.
We can discuss this. You could continuously connect these theory black holes, but they can engage with large. Well, in a series of small steps, but they can engage with larger and anti-supersymmetric.
Oh yeah, you think so? Yeah. So it's real black holes aren't real black holes. So it's the mathematical.
So one side of the valley is realer than another?
Yeah, I think I...
You're saying these are perfectly good points in the same landscape?
Yeah, but they're not compactations.
We don't know
why
we're
living in 3 plus 1 dimension. But non-compact things match with the swamp land.
You mean what? This is one term?
Well, this is about this notion that not every field theory construction can actually be coupled through. Often, in non-compact models, partial compactifications, there are various things which are allowed to essentially, like monoptic infinities, anomalies, and so on. So it's not clear that you would be able to realize any specific phenomenon like the one he's talking about in a compact model.
It's also related to, well, this title, like the graviton here is not the graviton that we measure that pulls this in orbit around the sun.
X plus 1, 3 plus 1 dimension?
Or, that's part of it, yeah. I mean, here it's a blue ball.
So the rest is compacted by it.
But in terms of graviton, it's a blue ball.
Yeah. But the question is this, in terms of fundamental strength theory, and is this a globally defined description of this point in the landscape? And is there any problems with it? Is there any reason why we didn't end up here?
No, in the simplest case, this is ADS 5 cos S 5.
But it's the other way around. I mean, these are better solutions.
From a mathematical perspective, these are better.
These are better. That's what I'm saying. These are better because they're superposition boundary conditions are not some results.
Yeah, yeah, so these are better than what we're
well, except they are anti de Sitter, so.
I'm not saying they are where we are in any sense of the word, but as far as making predictions from string theory in the string landscape, these are perfectly good points in the landscape that you have to consider when you do statistical studies of the landscape, right?
Oh, well.
Yeah, but if you're going to put priors on it, I mean, this is a gauge theory with no gravity, you know, it's constant zero.
Yeah.
That has to do with the non-compactness. So you wouldn't consider the. But if Eva were here, I don't know if she is, she would be saying that you can use this kind of intuition to describe these long throats that we've been hearing about all along.
But wouldn't Michael Douglas say that when I do a statistical analysis of the string landscape, I should include everything, whether it looks like us or not?
No.
No, he wouldn't.
He wouldn't?
He would not, no.
This thing is a principle disconnected from the landscape which we might think we will. Because the SNI, sure.
Because it's like the super dimension world separates this from the usual
worlds
that we talk about. It's not compactified. Right. It's not compactified, and it's has to come from the other cylinder. But we have three dimensions which are not compactified, right?
Right.
Yeah. And if Randall Sundin, whatever it was, zero is correct, then we could have four dimensions which are not compactified. How do we know that this is not a perfectly reasonable point to be in?
The issue, I mean, there's a lot of things that you're going to go over. And part of the issue is that because this is asymptotic to VDS, you can't make a transition from that to something that you should say similar. So there's no process that would take you from one to the other. It's like saying, why aren't we doing, really, you know, state by system?
This is a super selection rule in steering lens.
Yes.
And this is in a difference.
Yes.
Right.
So we always have this input as part of this super selection rule.
So there are three uncompactified dimensions and everything else compactified. Is that part of the super selection sector that I don't have to consider four uncompactified dimensions and less compactified?
Each
one is
in the other.
That's
not there.
That would be interesting to figure out.
Well, no.
Does anyone have to spend a while in three?
Dimensionality in the sense that we care about is not a super selection. That would be not a super selection. This is strictly infinite. The ADS really is this, you know, infinity in the boundary condition really is locked in the
form. We can identify the point of infinity and make it a.
It could be points in the landscape we care about. They're very much like this, since they're locked in the form. But this space time can't, strictly speaking, be hard for the landscape region.
Because there's some number of dimensions which haven't been detected.
Because of the ADS nature.
But if it's really strictly asymptotically, yes, then let's find any sort of finite element in the condition instead of just dies off. And that would be what keeps you looking.
But you could take one of these examples I've been discussing and at a very, very large radius modify it into something else. And most of what I said would still stand because it only depends on infrared physics. So
in the compact sediment.
For example, yeah.
Yeah, no, and that's
the way we can found the infrared landscape, the place where all these mechanisms are happening.
And there's no problems with making that globally valid. There's no anomalies or
other challenges.
But that in some sense would be the sort of issue of this one point. We try to fit this into something that's not a four-dimensional landscape.
What are the obstacles? What are the instructions? I mean, it's already coming out of the surface.
So the question is, can you fit it into something that will go with
the usual temple?
I don't personally think it's a problem.
You always have to.
So you expect to only be able to absorb the flux in certain number of randomness.
That's right.
Truncation on end.
But in that period, right?
You know, 1,000 is definitely not a fold, right?
Isn't the statement also, I mean, one of Cameron's sort of statements, I don't know, like, there, you know, there are things which aren't elements there that you just don't see in string theory. You just don't see it. Mm-hmm. There's no obvious reason why not. You could also have some string theory.
There are all kinds of things that we don't know or disconnected from. I think interesting, which would spoil any kind of notion of counting. There are all kinds of four-dimensional things which they're continuous infinities.
Right.
Which for all we know could be, you know, with lots of supersymmetry and stuff, which for all we know could be not connected in a moduli space, but could be connected in some larger sense.
So,
you know,
I think the sort of, there are these personal walls, connections to the subject
The real answer is that. The real answer is maybe that this one you can construct an architect.
Thank you.